From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are new revelations today about that meeting that Donald Trump Jr. took with a Kremlin-connected lawyer. A Russian-American lobbyist and former Soviet counterintelligence officer confirms he was at that meeting, too, a detail Trump Jr. did not disclose. Meanwhile, President Trump returns to the U.S. after his trip to Paris, sharing a long televised goodbye with President Macron and his wife Brigitte, holding hands, slapping backs. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, that was this morning, but President Trump will land with the news of this former counterintelligence officer, a Soviet officer, at this meeting with Donald Trump Jr. What more do we know about him?
Well, the man's name is Rinat Akhmetshin, and he has told the Washington Post and the Associated Press that he was also in the room. As you noted, he had been in the Russian military. He was a former Soviet counterintelligence officer. He is also an American citizen. He is a dual citizen with Russia and the United States. He has a role at an Eurasian Institute in Washington, D.C. So he is somebody who was lobbying against the sanctions that were imposed on Russia for human rights violations. This has been the talked about Magnitsky Act. And that's why when I've said before, when they were talking about adoption in that meeting, that has everything to do with sanctions. And we now know that there were at least five or six people, if you include a translator, in that room.
Well, and this is because President Putin banned American adoptions of Russian children after the U.S. launched these sanctions against Russia because of civil rights violations, including the death, the mysterious death of a civil rights activist in jail. But Domenico, what I don't understand is we know that these
everything.
Well, we know
this is very murky.
It is, and but you have to question why isn't the White House stepping up and being as transparent as Donald Trump, the president, is claiming his son is. We know that these emails surfaced with Jared Kushner's lawyers in June because he had to redo his security clearance. So deep in the White House, people knew that these emails existed. Why wasn't there some sort of preparation for the trail to go to Donald Trump Jr. as it did?
Well, I think that it's a valid question for the White House. I mean, it's a question that we're going to continue to ask and is been asked and is being asked of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for example, who's been the deputy press secretary who has been the lead in a lot of these press briefings of late. We're not getting a lot of straight answers, frankly. So it's very difficult to say why they weren't prepared on it or why they would not release the information. The fact is, what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said was that she thought the only thing inappropriate was that somebody leaked that this document had been updated. So this is not for a White House that has been, you know, President Trump praising his son for transparency, quote unquote. He was on television for an hour on Fox on Sean Hannity's show, did not talk about this other person who was in the room. That's not very transparent. You have a White House that's more critical of leaks of information that's found out to be true rather than actually releasing the information and being forthcoming with the American public. So, you know, are they more concerned about, transparency or leaks? It seems leaks.
It's really hard to understand, but it's a lesson for those who have children. Tell me everything, you know, because it is going to come out. Look, you have the healthcare bill that's being considered. You have the Government Accounting Office giving a new accounting of a scoring of it on Monday. You have two senators both saying they won't support it. All it will take is one more, and they won't even be able to have the vote on whether to vote on it. Does this story of Trump Jr., the letter, the way the White House is looking at this point, does that impact Republican senators and how they might act on something like the healthcare bill? Are they tied?
It's a good question because there's two ways to look at it. I mean, one, that there's so much drama coming from the White House and such an difficult storyline that's coming out of the White House that it could make Republican senators feel like they want some distance from this White House and don't really want to have to push forward on Donald Trump's agenda. At the same time, there's another school of thought that this could be helpful to Republicans in the Senate where they can go about the work of the healthcare bill without there being too bright of a spotlight spotlight on some of the more odious measures within the bill as it relates to public opinion, like, for example, cutting Medicaid drastically versus the projection that would be on the current path. So, you know, there's those two ways of looking at it. As Mitch McConnell has said, who is the person who's shepherding this agenda, he could certainly use a little less drama from the White House.
Yeah, it's been said that the new bill he's proposed to shift further to the right. One analysis is that at least he can say to the conservatives he was trying to appeal to, I tried, even though it might fail. Really briefly, we talked yesterday about Macron and Trump and the backslapping and handshaking and the fact that he's now being called the Trump whisperer in Europe because he might be the person able to talk to President Trump about climate change, about taking Russia to task. Your thoughts?
I mean, you don't want to make too much out of one attempted meeting. You know, he attempted with lots of pomp and circumstance to try a more personal approach rather than shunning him and isolating him. He's taking the view that the United States needs to be in the fold of strong Western countries because they're going to have interests that overlap with each other, including security interests. So he's trying to take this approach to see if playing to Donald Trump's sensibilities will work. And that the book is still out on whether or not France is going to get what it wants out of this.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro on the end of another dizzying week. See you next week, Domenico.
Always fun.
The Trump administration's scaled-down travel ban limits some refugees and visitors from entering the United States. But the Senate is moving ahead with legislation to help one group, Afghans who aided the U.S. war effort there and face threats because of it. A Senate bill would allow 4,000 Afghans to get special visas, but critics say that still would leave many behind. Dorian Marina has our report.
This 30-year-old Afghan man remembers the day a stranger approached him while he was walking home from work in Kabul. The stranger seemed to know a lot about him, his name, where his family lived, and most important, that he was working with a U.S. development agency. The brief conversation ended with an implied warning: stop working with the Americans or be killed.
I was really, really scared. I was scared to death. My lips were shaking, and now I can imagine, and still I am speechless about that situation.
The Afghan, who told his story via Skype from Kabul, asked that we not use his name to protect his safety. As a teen, he and his parents fled Afghanistan, driven out by the Taliban. After the U.S. invasion, they returned, and he joined the U.S.-backed efforts to stabilize the country. He worked for a USAID-funded project helping farmers grow tomatoes, dairy, and apricots. He also worked at the American University in Kabul. His work soon drew death threats from local militants.
The extremists is all over in here, you know. It's all over, even our neighborhoods. They don't like us to work with foreigners, you know. They don't want us. They do everything to stop us.
He fled to a different part of the city and went into hiding. But he soon returned to his job. He had to support his parents, wife, and young son. Today, they're all hiding.
We are living in fear, you know, and the extremists is all over. And if they find out, then who knows what will happen.
He's applied for a special visa program to bring his family to safety in the U.S., but the line is long and the timeline uncertain. Mac McEachin is a policy expert with the International Refugee Assistance Project. His group helps Afghans whose work with the U.S. makes them targets. He says they're essential to the war and development efforts.
In a place like Afghanistan, the mission really doesn't get done without them.
But that can leave them open to risks as U.S. troops return home or aid agencies pull out.
These are small communities. Everyone knows everyone. And so it's never a surprise or it's never a question as to who is working with the Americans. It's only a question of how well protected are they going to be.
The U.S. created the visa program for Afghans in 2009. It's called the Special Immigrant Visa, or SIV. Those who get one can move to the U.S., but there aren't enough visas. Last year, about 2,600 Afghans came to the U.S. under the program, and the State Department is in the process of admitting 2,500 more. But there are still 13,000 applicants waiting. The average processing time is 16 months.
So if you think of the need as this giant reservoir of water, the SIV is like a soda straw.
Steve Miska is a retired Army colonel who served in Iraq and on the National Security Council in the Obama administration.
There's no way that the SIV is going to be able to address the entire need.
He'd like to see the U.S. develop a more comprehensive policy to protect local allies. That's a goal that Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois shares. But he says the fight is hampered by a lack of funding and public attention. He says if the U.S. doesn't take care of the Afghans, it goes against military ethics and plays into the hands of enemies.
We did it in Vietnam, and you know, the concern is we do it here, basically abandoning people that work with us. It really does affect national security for the long run.
The Senate's defense spending bill would fund 4,000 more visas next year. Meanwhile, many more thousands of Afghans wait, hoping that one of those visas brings their family to safety. I'm Dorian Marina.
This week, an FDA panel unanimously recommended that the agency approve, for the first time, gene therapy for certain leukemia patients. They would send their cells to the drug maker Novartis, where they'd be genetically engineered, weaponized, and returned to fight the cancer. The treatment, known as CTL19, was developed by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania and licensed to Novartis. We're going to speak to a family that has greatly benefited already in trials, but there are dangerous potential side effects. It doesn't work for everyone. It's hugely expensive, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But the hope is it will be available at many medical centers across the country to save lives. Dr. Stephen Grupp is director of the Cancer Immunotherapy Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or CHOP. They run a trial program treating about 60 patients a year. Dr. Grupp, welcome.
Thanks for having me on. It's really exciting.
Well, I bet. And I know people are sitting up and listening with a lot of hope. And so let's make sure we explain this correctly. It's not a drug, but a gene therapy. Some scientists call this a living drug. What does it mean exactly? How would it work?
So typically we think about drugs as being pills or injections, and this is a completely different way to do things. It's, as you said, collecting cells from an individual patient, genetically reprogramming them, and then giving those cells back to the patient so that they can actually go after cancer in their body. So this is an immunotherapy and a brand new way of doing things.
And they're frozen. The cells are frozen and flown out to Novartis and then flown back. Talk more about the technique. We understand that it employs a disabled form of HIV. This is the virus that causes AIDS. But it's disabled. It's not going to be causing AIDS. It's quite a soldier, in effect, and it's going to be carrying this new genetic material to the T cells in the cancer patient's body to try to reprogram them?
Yeah, this is not the AIDS virus. It's what it started out many, many years ago. All the pieces of the virus that it can actually make a person sick are long gone. You can just remove those things genetically. So the only thing that's left is the ability to change the DNA of a particular kind of cell called a T cell, which are cells in your body that can fight infection. And you make that change to the T cell, and now the T cell is reprogrammed to fight cancer.
And this treatment that we're describing, it's for a rare form of cancer.
So the cancer that we're going after here is acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which in kids is the most common form of cancer, but compared to some adult cancers is relatively rare. You're exactly right. And this is for patients whose disease has come back after chemotherapy. So regular kids with this disease would get chemo, and hopefully that would work for them, and it does for a large fraction of them. But in patients where the disease comes back, that's where we go after this stuff.
What are the concerns? There are side effects. One can be fatal. So tell us about that.
So the principal side effect of these cells is this reaction called a cytokine release syndrome. It really depends on how much leukemia the patient has. So the amazing thing about these cells is that even if patients have literally pounds of leukemia in their body, these T cells will go in, they will attack the leukemia wherever it is, they will grow to the extent that they can kill the leukemia, even if there's a huge amount of leukemia in the body. So that part is great for the patient. But the challenge is, in these patients who have a lot of leukemia, they can get sick, and they can get this cytokine release syndrome. And the mild form is fever and muscle aches and kind of like a very bad case of the flu. But the more severe form in patients who have a great deal of leukemia can lead to being in the intensive care unit for up to a week or so.
Have I got this right, that this seems to work with these childhood leukemias? Because as you mentioned, these are blood disorders. And might it have the same effect someday on tumors or masses?
The next step in trying to make this work is to make this work in solid tumor masses. And, you know, what we mean is things like lung cancer or pancreatic cancer or breast cancer. And that is something that we haven't done yet. It is absolutely the next step in the research. And this is utterly transformative for leukemia, for blood cancers. But for it to be really changing the entire field of cancer, we have to show how to do this in solid tumor masses. I think it can be done, but that's the work of the next 5 years.
Are you hearing, I can't imagine that your switchboard hasn't been flooded with parents of other children who are desperate for this treatment.
Oh, yeah. And we you know, for patients with leukemia, we try to help those patients out, and we get patients from all over the United States. For patients with other cancers, of course, their hope is that this cell therapy would be available for other kinds of cancer. And that, you know, I have to tell them that we're not there yet.
Well, but we understand that you learned about the possibilities through what's described as a really frightening experience with a young girl named Emily Whitehead who had this form of leukemia. Tell us what condition she was in and, you know, how you suggested to her family that maybe she would get this experimental therapy.
So Emily Whitehead was actually the first pediatric patient ever treated with this kind of therapy, and the first patient with this particular disease, ALL, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So the parents and Emily herself are absolutely pioneers. They came to us with Emily's situation being very dire. She had relapsed a couple of times. At this point, her leukemia was not responding to any treatment. Her bone marrow, which is where leukemia is, was full of leukemia cells, and we gave her the cell therapy. And she actually did develop this cytokine release syndrome that we've been talking about. She did get quite sick, but she was also the patient in whom we learned how to control the toxicity. So the process of the T cells fighting the cancer activates the immune system to a very significant level, because that's what the T cells are doing. Mm. They're going all over the body, and they're killing literally billions of cancer cells. In the process, the immune system gets very activated, and the drug is intended to sort of push down the immune system a little bit, so there's not this degree of activation that actually can be dangerous to the patient. And in the patients where that drug reverses the side effect, they often can get better in hours, and that's what happened in Emily's case.
And Dr. Grupp, we're going to be speaking with Emily, who's now a 12-year-old. She was 7 when you treated her. Anything you'd like us to say to her?
So I was just at the FDA talking about the potential approval of this, and Emily was there with her dad. She is an absolutely amazing individual. Obviously, she's sort of become the international face of cell therapy, and it's just every time I see her, either in clinic visits or just out in these kind of events, it's great to see how well she's doing.
Well, sure. Dr. Stephen Grupp, director of the Cancer Immunotherapy Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, who led Novartis' global trial of the treatment we've been talking about. Dr. Grupp, thank you.
Absolutely. Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, there are lingering questions that we'll take up down the road, but as you heard, Emily Whitehead was the first child in the world to have her immune system trained to fight cancer through this gene therapy. She'd been diagnosed with pre-B acute lymphoblastic leukemia in 2010 at 5, a leukemia so aggressive in her case, her doctors gave up. But then her parents tried Dr. Grupp's clinical trial. Now, Emily almost died in that trial. Her immune system fought the therapy. She went into a coma. But Dr. Grupp found a drug to reverse that. She is now cancer-free. We want to just quickly check in with the Whiteheads. Emily and her parents, Tom and Carrie, have set up the Emily Whitehead Foundation to help other families. Let's start with Dad. Tom, in those terrible moments, did you question trying gene therapy?
No, we never questioned it, because at the time that we entered her into this trial, we knew chemotherapy couldn't save her, and our only other option was to take her home on hospice until she passed.
Mm. But then she wakes up from this coma that she'd fallen into because her immune system is so fighting this therapy, after Dr. Grupp finds a way to suppress the immune system, and the cancer is completely gone. I can't imagine that moment.
Yeah, it was one of the best call I ever received in my life. She went from where they said, call your family in tonight, she might not be here in the morning, to when he finally called me and he said, Tom, it worked. We can't find any cancer in her. You know, I felt at that point, it seemed like a dream, because we had thought about that for 2 years. of what it would be like to have someone tell us that. And, you know, it was just one of the best days of our life.
Carrie, we were surprised to hear that CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is now treating 60 or so patients a year, Emily being the very first, and now 60 or so going through. If people can get in the trials, they can get this treatment before this FDA approval. What would you want to tell these people who are going through this?
You know, we tell people that it's just incredible. I mean, you know, everybody was in the same situation that we were in. They were told that their child, you know, was completely out of options. And so we know exactly how they feel going into it. You know, hearing about Emily's story gives them a lot of hope. And we have a private Facebook page for the families. And so we keep in touch that way so that we can all share stories and experiences.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, I understand that you're 12 going on 33. with quite a story to tell. Some people are nervous about this idea of altering genes. We heard about side effects. What would you say? What are you telling people now about why this should be approved?
I just tell people that it helps kids to have a good life after they're done with the medicine so they can do fun things like I'm doing today.
And what are you doing today?
Well, I get to go on fun trips and I like to hang out with my best friends and I like to play with my dog, Lucy.
Yeah. What would you tell them if they're scared?
I just tell them to always believe, always keep fighting, and never give up.
Yeah. Emily Whitehead, thank you so much. The first child to have her immune system trained to fight cancer through gene therapy. Emily, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks to her parents as well. As we said, an FDA panel has recommended approval of this gene therapy for certain leukemia patients. Your thoughts? We're going to have more at hereandnow.org, where we'd love to hear from other families, maybe other questions. Share your stories. Hereandnow.org.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has called in the National Guard and issued a curfew for the city of Burlington in the wake of unprecedented flooding due to severe storms across the southeast region of the state this week. Sheldon Dutez is an anchor and reporter for WISN 12 News Milwaukee. He joins us now from Burlington. Sheldon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, because I imagine that things are busy today. I mean, what are the conditions in Burlington like?
A lot of the streets are impassable. The flooding has, it's just been unprecedented for the last few days. The Fox River runs through town and it crested at 16 and a half feet early Thursday morning. And that's 3 feet higher than the previous record. So a lot of people are dealing with flooded basements. Drivers are being turned around at certain intersections because they can't get through because roads are flooded out. I was at a ballpark this morning, Little League Field, and it was completely submerged underwater. So the whole area, this part of Burlington, very saturated with a lot of the floodwater from the rain that fell earlier this week.
Well, and so you mentioned people with flooded basements. I mean, have folks been displaced? Are certain people in risk of losing their homes?
Well, I just talked with the Red Cross. They have set up a shelter at one of the local high schools here. And although people have not checked in, people have stopped by to pick up water or to charge their cell phones and so forth. But one of my colleagues interviewed a gentleman who was recording on his cell phone as gushing water was coming through his basement and filling it up in a matter of minutes. So people are staying in their homes, it seems like so far, and just kind of dealing with the conditions. Some of that water has started to recede, though.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, as you mentioned, though, I mean, these conditions are pretty severe. Record-breaking river levels for the Fox River, more than 5 feet over flood stage. Good news that it's going down, but tell us a little bit about the National Guard being brought in. I mean, what are they being asked to do, and is their presence visible around the city?
Well, the governor declared a state of emergency. Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency for Burlington, which is in Racine County, and two surrounding counties that were also hard hit by this storm. So about 60 members of the National Guard are here in Burlington, and you can definitely see and feel their presence. They've got their military vehicles set up strategically at different intersections that are blocked off. So they're kind of helping to direct cars around roads that are not passable and just keeping a presence here in this area.
Mm. And I just have to ask, I mean, have there been any fatalities?
So far, there have not been any reports of any serious injuries or any loss of life. And a lot of people here are very grateful that it's just been limited to property damage, although the property damage is very extensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's significant to have property damage, but I want to echo that sentiment. It's good news so far that no one's been hurt or killed. But are there threats of more storms? What's the weather looking like for the weekend?
It's a little gloomy right now. There's a bit of a break from the rain at the moment, but the skies look overcast and cloudy right now. A lot of people out here are hoping that things stay dry for the rest of the weekend so that the water can continue to recede, because it's going to take a few days for everything to get back down to normal operating levels for this area. But everyone's just waiting, trying to clean up. You can hear the sound of generators throughout town, and different cleaning crews have started to arrive to help clean some of these basements and dry them out.
Well, Sheldon Dutez is an anchor and reporter for WISN 12 News Milwaukee, speaking to us from Burlington, Wisconsin, where they've been experiencing incredible amounts of flooding. Sheldon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ben Winter's best-selling novel, Underground Airlines, asks a difficult question. What would the United States be like if slavery never ended? Victor is narrator and at the troubled heart and soul of this alternate history. He's a bounty hunter who searches for escaped slaves who use the Underground Airlines, a modern-day underground railroad, as they attempt to escape to freedom. The book comes out in paperback next week, and we spoke with Ben Winters about Underground Airlines when the book was published last year. I asked him where he was personally and professionally when he decided he wanted to write a book like this.
Professionally, I was wrapping up the third in a trilogy of these sort of speculative fiction mystery novels that I had done. So as an artist, as an author, I was really looking forward to doing something else, using kind of mystery tropes and alternate history tropes. And then as a human, as an American, I was, and like so many of us, just continually shocked and horrified and distressed by incidences of police violence in African-American communities. And I guess I just began thinking and then researching and then writing about the origins of racism and racist violence in this country, which all emerges from slavery. So I that's where the book came from. It became an idea of taking this figurative idea, in a way, slavery is still with us, and making it literal.
Right. You know, and the other thing about your book is it just reminds us how, again, it's speculative fiction, but in truth, like, history, the path that a nation takes, even individuals take, can really turn on a dime with just a couple little tweaks here to a timeline. I mean, for example, in your book, President Lincoln is assassinated in 1861. In the earliest days, wait, is it before?
He's on the way. He's on the way to be inaugurated. In my
That's
book,
right.
He's
in
he left Springfield, as he did in real life. He left Springfield on a train to go to Washington. He made stops along the way. In real life, he got there. In my novel, he is assassinated.
Right.
And now, in the present day, slavery remains in four southern states. And crucially to the novel, the fugitive slave law, now called the Fugitive Persons Law, is still in force, meaning that, as it was in antebellum times, if a slave escapes, it is the responsibility of local law enforcement to return him or her to their quote-unquote owner.
So that brings us to Victor, the main character in the book. He is a bounty hunter of slaves, but he's also black. Tell us about Victor.
We find out fairly early on he is himself an escaped slave, or a person born to labor, or PB, who was caught and, instead of being returned, sort of forced to work for the United States Marshal Service as an undercover enforcer of the Fugitive Persons Law.
Well, there is a terrific passage in the book, Underground Airlines, where Victor describes a little bit about the reality of his life. And I'm wondering if you could just, if you could read that for us.
Sure. I am an undercover operative in a dangerous line of work, but understand that I am also an African-American male living in the United States of America. There are going to be checkpoints. I am going to get stopped. Every once in a while, I'm going to have to dump out my bag under the watchful eye of some kind of lawman, sheriff's deputy, patrol officer, state trooper, what have you. When that sort of BS happened, I had no choice but to submit. I had no badge, no ID. I was true undercover right down the line. If you saw the way I traveled, if you went through my suitcase or the trunk of my car, you'd think I was a thief, some kind of con man. Which I was, of course. Really, that's exactly what I was. I was a thief. I was some kind of con man.
Con man? I mean, who is Victor conning? I mean, himself? Everyone else around him?
Well, day to day, that's what he does for a living, right? Yeah. He cons people. He goes undercover and pretends to be someone that he is not to achieve an objective. But he is. He's conning himself because he tells us very early on that there is nothing he can do about his fate. He is resigned to his existence.
Mm. So there's a middle part of that passage where Victor says, there are going to be checkpoints. I am going to get stopped. Every once in a while, I'm going to have to dump out my bag under the watchful eye of some kind of lawman. Now, that could have been written as fact today. It didn't even need to be in a work of fiction, right? I mean, I'm sure many African Americans feel that way. I'm just wondering, I mean, this brings us right to a question which I know you've grappled with and a lot of people have asked you. You're white. Why did you decide to write in the voice of a black man in the book?
Well, for this book, there could be no other point of view character. You know, it is a book very much about the history of anti-black racism in this country. And as you point out, Meghna, in that passage, that could very easily be written in a non-alternate history. I've started to think of this book as an alternate history that isn't alternate enough. So, yeah, I'm white. I am white, and I wrote this book because I think it is incumbent upon white people, white authors very much included, to think about racism, to grapple with racism, and to engage with it.
I take your point. And I mean, obviously, the story of slavery is one of the defining stories of America, and it is a story of black Americans and white Americans. But
that's right.
I'm curious about how you confronted the challenge or question of, could you write in an authentic voice, not being black yourself?
Yeah, I confronted it in the way that I think it is, you know, beholden upon any white person who is writing a character who is not white with extraordinary care and knowledge. I tried to steep myself in as much knowledge as I could steep myself in. One of the first things I read was this long article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic about reparations. I read Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison and Octavia Butler. I mean, I tried to read as much African-American literature as I could, stories that in various ways expressed the black experience in America, and also just by talking to people, by knowing people, you know, and by living in the world. And when I got to a certain point working on the book, I had to just say, well, this is my main character. This is my guy. And I'm not going to try to create some quote unquote black voice or black way of thinking, because all you have to do is talk to more than one black person. You realize there is no such thing as a universal way that black people are and black people think, which isn't to say that black Americans aren't shaped by the BS that they put up with and the indignities and the inequalities and the fear of violence that they deal with every day. But it was important to me to write this book. I feel that the book has, you know, fallen down a rabbit hole here.
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think we'd all be better off if every American, regardless of race, engaged as deeply as they could with the history of racism and its effect on our present as a nation. So I don't mean to put you, you know, on the defensive here. I'm very, very, I'm in awe of the book. But obviously, I mean, it's a question that you've been asked a lot.
And you can tell it's not an easy question to answer. And I think it's important to acknowledge that there's sort of another level of issues here, which has to do with the fact that the attention that my book has gotten and sort of the framing of the book as being somehow pathbreaking or daring or whatever, when there are so many authors of color who have written about racism and even in sort of speculative or science fiction contexts and not received the attention. And so that enters into it, because I have to acknowledge that although my book I feel is valuable and it's about, in many ways, it's about white privilege, the book itself in a weird way becomes an example of that.
Well, I wonder what the process of researching, thinking about, talking to other people and writing this book, did that transform your understanding or how you view slavery and its effect on America today?
Yes. I mean, I think like a lot of white people, I think that I grew up with the idea that the most important thing was not to be racist, you know, to see everybody as equal. And I think that is obviously so. But I think that unlike many black people, I never had to deal with the sort of day-to-day racism that comes from, not from just individuals being mean or being racist, but from institutions. And so once I began, my awareness of these things heightened and heightened and heightened and heightened as I was working on the book.
Hmm. Now, Ben, a lot of readers know you for your The Last Policeman trilogy, and I'm just wondering, with Underground Airlines, I got a sense that maybe there's the possibility of a sequel. Is it too soon to ask if you want to continue the story?
Yeah, well, I don't think so. Having spent several years writing a trilogy of novels all about how we behave under the specter of impending death, and then having spent the next couple of years writing a novel about how we behave under the shadow of slavery and racism. Racism is so much worse than death, you know, because death is inevitable and it is organic and there's nothing we can do about it. We just have to deal with it. Racism is something that, like, we tolerate and we are the beneficiaries of it sometimes without even thinking about it. And that is a much scarier thing.
Hmm. Well, Ben Winter's new book is Underground Airlines. Ben, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
An honor. Thank you very much.
Okay, who's hungry? A few weeks ago, we told you we'd be checking in on food festivals all summer. Happening this week, the Copper River Salmon Jam in Cordova, Alaska, the Slug Burger Festival in Corinth, Mississippi. Don't worry, it's a hamburger made of beef and soybean grits, no slugs. And today and tomorrow, Corn Fest, celebrating Camp Verde, Arizona's sweet corn since 1991. Now, you might be thinking, what, Arizona? Corn? We think of Iowa and Illinois. But Camp Verde sweet corn is famous across the state, and it's all thanks to Brenda Hauser. She joins us now from KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Brenda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And we understand that about 50 years ago, you said, let's just plant a little corn.
I did. I had a garden, and I had tomatoes and things, and I could do that myself, but I thought, I need some corn, and I really didn't want to do that by myself. So my husband said he would grow me an acre. Well, that was too much for just us to eat. It's a lot of corn. So we just began to sell it. I just put a sign out by the road, and people would drive down a little dusty road in their high heels, and they would pick their own corn for 50 cents a dozen.
But now, from that acre, you're at 60 acres. Your roadside stand sells thousands of ears of corn. But I want to refer back to the dusty road. How is corn growing in Arizona? We thought it needed a lot of water.
Well, it does. But we have a river. Our farm is by the river, so we're able to irrigate it. And then most of the water then goes back into the river. So we're able to water our corn and serve the people of Arizona fresh sweet corn.
Well, and now they have decided to thank you, apparently, with this corn festival, which sounds fantastic. What are some of the events that happen there?
At the corn festival, we have lots of events for the kids. We have a water slide. We have cornhole contests.
Okay,
we have,
I heard about that. What is a cornhole contest?
Oh, the cornhole. You know, it's like two big boards with holes in it, and you throw bean bags. And you're scored for how close your beanbag is to the hole in the board.
Okay. Well, you also have Who's the Fastest Corn Shucker.
Yes, and I have never won that contest, by the way.
Well, that's okay, because you started the whole thing. So, but corn eating, all these festivals have to have eating. Hog
yes.
Callers, corniest joke tellers. Each of the festivals we're looking at is unique, and that certainly makes yours unique. Also, a corn king and corn queen. How coveted is that title?
Oh, it's a wonderful thing. And usually they are from our extended care facility in our little town.
Oh.
So, yeah, so it's very special. And they get a crown and, you know, they get to be congratulated by everybody. So it's a wonderful thing.
Well, we know that this festival calls on volunteers who devote hours to getting it put on. And part of that is bathing the hundreds of ears of corn in tubs of water. Remind us why. What do you do with this corn?
Well, we pick it, you know, that day, and we bring it to this town square, which is where our festival is. And then we soak it. We like to soak it for an hour or so.
It's still in the husks. Yeah.
Still in the husk. Mm-hmm. And then we have a big roaster, and we just put it on the roaster in the husk. And then we have butter and salt and everything after it's roasted.
You know, I'm wondering, you could just put it on the sidewalk.
Yes.
Isn't it like 100, 110 degrees there?
Yes, it's been very, very warm. Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, we're reading it's so hot that volunteers are only allowed to sign up for 2-hour slots. We read a few weeks ago the festival needed 110 slots filled and only had about 30. Are you going to have enough?
Oh, I think so. I was looking at all the statistics this morning, and it looks like they've just about got everything covered.
Okay.
And boy, 2 hours, you know, most of us are not young, and so 2 hours is about the maximum.
Well, it just looks so terrific. There's also going to be the Fort Verde Excelsiors, who will be playing the Prescott Champions in vintage baseball with the mm-hmm. rules from before the Civil War and a softer baseball, no gloves. And if they curse, it's a 25-cent penalty. When you're there, when you're at the Corn Fest, I mean, are you thinking about, wow, I planted some corn, and here's what happened?
I know. It's pretty amazing because it was such a simple little thing. I mean, I didn't know if anybody would buy corn, you know, in our area. And it was really small 50 years ago. And so, yeah, and it's developed. I have a wonderful daughter-in-law who runs it now and grandsons who plant it. And, you know, it's a really enlightening and satisfying to see it, what it's turned into.
Well, what a gift to the community, too. That's Brenda Hauser of Hauser & Hauser Farms in Camp Verde, Arizona. Brenda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
By the way, Brenda was also mayor there for a bit, what she can't do. If you can't make it to Arizona this week, maybe stop by the Kansas Wheat Festival in Wellington or the California Wine Festival in Santa Barbara. There's the Elsie Dairy Festival, Elsie, Michigan, the Porter Peach Festival, Porter, Oklahoma, the Northwest Raspberry Festival in Linden, Washington. You have something going on, let us know, as other listeners have, at hearnow.org. Of course, Meghna, a little sampler coming our way would be nice. I'm just saying. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.